So I'm here today with Sophie Hoyle, our current resident at Rupert, and we're here to discuss a little bit her work that she's been exploring whilst here and the screening that she did at Editorial Project Space on the 28th of January. Hi, Sophie.
Hi.
Could you talk a little bit about what you were looking at whilst you were here this past month?
Sure. I was expanding on the research I have been doing around mental health, anxiety, and trauma, and looking specifically at the Lithuanian context, mental health treatment here. Maybe cultural perceptions of mental health, whether it's talked about publicly, and approaches to treatment in relation to the kind of state funding available for different mental health services and the generational differences between since 1991, the kind of post-Soviet times.
And a lot of your work looks at the relationship between systemic problems or in particularly in Britain with an era of austerity and embodied experiences of that. And you showed some films at Editorial which explored that very powerfully. Can you talk a little bit more about how you represent this relationship and why you're interested in that?
Sure. So I began using moving image and sound to try and express some embodied experiences of anxiety disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder, and think of a or come up with the form that had an effective impact and through this was able to evoke empathy in other people. I've been talking about anxiety or trauma in lots of different ways, yet somehow with the videos that I'd came into making around 5 years ago seemed to be able to convey certain aspects of embodied experiences of anxiety that I hadn't been able to get across before.
Yeah, you were saying that when you were using images from of violence from the Middle East in particular. Some people couldn't relate to it, perhaps because it was so ubiquitous, and that's why you moved towards more abstract imagery, is that it?
I'd found when I was using specific types of imagery, perhaps it was the audience who was seeing them at that time who may not have like a personal relationship with the Middle East, and because these images are kind of all pervasive, they're in news media and social media, and they have previously served a specific function, I guess, to like increase awareness or to motivate action, you know, usually if they're used in like charity campaigns, for example. And I think people had learned to filter them out or had become desensitized to them. And so there seemed to be, when I presented them to other people, a kind of lack of empathy or a lack of connection. Yet, whenever I made these images, which were a lot more sort of close up, abstracted representations of the body, people were able to, connect with it more.
Do you think that because there is this sort of ongoing debate about the role of representation, whatever that means, I know that's a and also abstraction. And often when it comes to thinking about and raising awareness of trauma, it does seem that abstraction seems to be, or images that are more abstract tends to be more powerful. Do you have a sense of why that might be?
Well, I guess there are so many different manifestations of anxiety or also post-traumatic stress disorder from complex trauma from, say, domestic violence, abuse, neglect, or poverty is also considered by some people as being a contributory factor to complex trauma, as well as to other events like a car crash or a natural disaster or military conflict. And I think maybe perhaps, I'm not sure, but abstraction to some extent allows a kind of, I don't want to say universalism, but a kind of relatability across a range of experiences, whereas people might see a specific context and assume that they can't relate to it at all. Whereas, yeah, I try and find a commonality, but it's not like a flattening of all anxiety and trauma into one sameness. They are, of course, all unique and different, but there could be some elements which cross over.
I think one of the ways that's that I mean I'm sort of using abstraction in scare quotes because in your films they in one way appear kind of abstract because they're very, very close-up shots of skin or blood. And we talked about this at your screening, but what's very interesting about these films is that you have different scales that you're working with. This very, very bodily, and I mean, it's incredibly uncomfortable to watch these kind of close-ups. That, and then you have in the usually through sound, the sense of something like a bigger scale or a bigger event, whether that's sound which evokes a kind of a war zone or I mean, for me, I heard something like a helicopter, but maybe it wasn't. So could you talk a little bit about these different scales of reference and experience and why you're interested in it?
Yeah, again, it was a kind of attempting to find a connection across different scales of experience from the micro to the macro. Yeah, just an interconnectedness, not like a flattening of all these experiences together, but it was more relating my experiences, having a diagnosis. Well, the diagnosis changed over my lifetime, according to different doctors or psychiatrists. And that can be quite common that you don't necessarily get always an accurate diagnosis from your first meeting. Because mental health, there's a lack of training and awareness in mental health, even in whether a sort of developed medical infrastructures like the UK. So relating a kind of personal experience, having a diagnosis of anxiety disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder, and then seeing connections or relating it to my family from the Middle East, the different kinds of experiences and anxieties or traumas that they've lived through, the different ways it's expressed, the kind of cultural differences, and yeah, finding that perhaps both in the UK, growing up in the UK, relating my own experiences to other people's experiences, realizing it's a collective condition, where a lot of people who've had adverse childhood experiences or have experienced other kinds of inequality or marginalization, like racism, homophobia, transphobia, have higher rates of mental illness. So relating the personal, individualized, or what I was told was an individual condition and way of treating it, relating it to wider collective scales.
That has an important implication to thinking about forms of care, and that's something that I know that you've been exploring here and also in your work more generally, that how we can think of different structures of care, maybe outside specific institutions, whether that's like the medical infrastructures or even institutions like the family. And you were talking about you've been exploring care kind of transculturally and how it plays out in different contexts. Can you speak a little bit about your research there?
I was looking at sort of transcultural psychiatry and how the dominant model of psychology and psychiatry at the moment has a kind of origin, kind of Western values of individualism, like an individual diagnosis and individual treatment. And I was just wondering if it's a collective experience, whether there could be collective forms of treatment as well. And I was interested in other socio-political contexts where forms of treatment are collective, whether they're like formalized or whether they're like more informal ways of treating, through community care.
Do you have an example of one? One that you came across in your...
I guess perhaps this is a generalization, but some older forms of care were on a collective scale, which were then with colonization, were then kind of became marginalized practices. And this sort of the model of the kind of modern Western medicine kind of overtook, and then treatment became individualized. So I can think of a few examples. One example I was thinking was, well, it was in research by Dr. Fornicraft on healthcare in developing countries, how, for example, when one individual family member is hospitalized, sometimes the entire family will stay in the hospital unit with them. So it's a kind of just a different attitude and approach to care. And another example was speaking with the artist Halid Haddal about practices in Egypt, like Zaar, which is a healing ritual using sound, and which is now being marginalized with this, the current dominant model of modern Western medicine. That's not to necessarily romanticize non-medical models or different cultural approaches to treatment, because a lot of the time it could be for economic reasons that care is on a collective level and not individualized and specifically tailored to the individual. But I was interested in seeing as individual treatment for a collective problem isn't necessarily working. It's sort of like managing the symptoms, but not really addressing the cause, the structural cause. I was just looking at other contexts to see, yeah, if there are other alternatives.
I think that's what's really powerful about your work, is that you're not necessarily saying one form of care or support is better than the other. It's also, what you're doing is also reminding us that there are alternatives outside of a dominant way of caring for people or thinking about care and the politics of care. And I know that's something that has been a part of your work looking at biohacking.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say what biohacking is? And then also your project that was looking at that and why you were interested in looking at biohacking.
Mm-hmm. Broadly speaking, biohacking is DIY biology and self-experimentation. So using the tools of science and using the training, the expertise and the methods and the tools and technology of science, but outside of specific institutional contexts. So you can make your own biology lab, for example. So I was exploring this through a workshop with this queer performance collective called Chimera Rosa. And they were proposing an experiment where we combined human hormones with plant cells just to see what would happen, that kind of experiment in interspecies hybridity. But mostly in the workshop we were talking about how this science, the ethics, the history and development and ethics of science, and how a lot of scientific practices are unethical in terms of how they tended to exploit subjects, how it's currently structured in that it's a mainly kind of for-profit industry funded by specific pharmaceutical companies or other people with a kind of investment in it, I guess.
A particular type of investment.
And whether it's possible to kind of decentralize that knowledge and expertise and sort of give it back to people so that they could treat themselves, so that they're able to have a bit more control and agency over their own body, also as a more sustainable form of care.
Mm.
You know, if people can treat themselves, it would potentially kind of relieve a lot of pressure on like medical services. Because at the moment, at least in the UK, health treatment there's a process of gatekeeping by GPs or nurses. You need to speak to an expert before they can sign off for you to have any medication or treatment.
Mm. But how does that, because the danger would be is that, well, it's up to all of us just to treat ourselves, which is, I know, something that you've critiqued a lot. How does that sort of, this biohacking, treating yourself, relate to also the need to, on a structural level, transform, in the UK, like the National Health Service, rather than just constantly finding alternatives, which are very easy to privatise and there aren't perhaps such rigorous kind of vetting structures around it.
I think maybe when I say treat yourself, I mean sort of treat each other as well, like have it more as a community knowledge rather than a shared knowledge. I can't remember the name, unfortunately, but there are a lot of, for example, alternative sexual health clinics run by people who might be transgender or gender non-conforming, and they were set up because of perhaps negative experiences in mainstream healthcare services.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of taking the tools and the knowledge to be able to do certain things yourself or as part of your community.
Right, and this is a sort of step in a way to perhaps, hopefully transform those dominant structures.
Yeah, it's definitely not, as far as I understood, the ideology isn't like a neoliberal sort of, do it yourself, provision by the state. Obviously, ideally, there would be provision available from the state, but given the context of austerity and funding cuts, it seems to be necessary to find other routes, other ways of doing things.
Mm. And you're returning to London tomorrow, so what steps are you doing, apart from unpacking and settling in?
So I will be continuing with a project called Psychic Refuge, looking at mental health in Palestine.
And you will be going to Palestine again, is that
correct? Yeah, I'll be going back in the spring.
Right, great.
So I was in Bethlehem in December, speaking to some mental health organisations there, and I'll be going back again.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you.
And stay in touch.
I will.
Bye.